He played with Santana and Charlie Watts. He's a 10-time Grammy nominee, and he's a very trusted name in Afro-Cuban music. Today, he's my guest. Ladies and gentlemen, meet Michael Spiro.
Welcome to The Power of Rhythm, a podcast with your host, Reinhard Flatischler, around the one thing that connects us all. Rhythm.
Hi, Michael. It's so great to finally have you here.
It's very sweet of you to have me. I am honored and very appreciative.
Now, let's right go to it. I'm very curious. When did you touch your first drum and what was this drum?
I was a very late starter. I didn't start playing music till I was 19.
Ah.
And my first drum was the conga drum.
Mm-hmm.
But it was... Sort of not an accident, but an American. And so, you know, logically I would have played drum set, but because I knew I was starting so late, you know, most of my friends said if they were playing music, they started when they were, you know, kids. And I thought, well, by the time I get good enough on drum set to play with people, you know, it takes 10 years to get really good. So I thought to myself, I'll play the Congo drum, you know, and it won't, you know, so I can, you know, get in there faster. So it was almost like an intentional attempt at trying to shortcut something.
Now, where did you grow up, in California?
No, I grew up all over the world. My father was an anthropologist, and so he was either doing field work or he was changing universities.
Mm-hmm.
And so I was one of those kids. People always thought I was, you know, what here in the United States we call an army brat, you know, where you're the child of a soldier and they keep moving you around the world. But I was the child of a professor. But because he was an anthropologist, we were always moving everywhere. So I never really had one place that I would have called home until I, you know, left my parents' home and became an adult.
So from the very first conga hit you did, till you merged with people like Carlos Santana and Charlie Watts, how did this enormous jump go? You know, how did you go from here to there?
It kind of went like this. Because I grew up on R&B and soul music, that was my roots, not so much rock and roll or anything. I was a Motown, James Brown kind of guy. One of the reasons I chose the conga drum is that, like, I really wanted to be the conga drummer in, you know, Aretha Franklin's band. You know, that would have been my dream come true. And so I bought these conga drums and didn't have any technique. I had no instruction. And back then, you know, music was really loud, you know, because of rock music. And I played my first gig, and for two or three days, I could, you know, my hands felt like they'd been run over by a truck. And I thought to myself, this can't be right. I've got to be doing something wrong. And I went to find a teacher. And in that process, he gave me some records to take home to listen to of music with the conga drum in it, which of course was folkloric music from Cuba. It was not music that I even, when I put it on, I went, it didn't do much for me, to tell you the truth. It sounded like kind of noise, like all this bang, clack, clack, boom, boom. I'm like, what in the hell? But I was fascinated that it seemed like chaos to me, except they all started at the same time and they all ended at the same time. So it wasn't chaos to them. So what happened was that I sort of just kept listening to it to try to figure out what was going on. And the more I listened to it, the more I started to kind of go, wow, that's kind of cool. Or, wow, listen to what just happened there. And so I started to learn and explore Cuban music because it seemed to be where the conga drum kind of came from. And slowly but surely, you know, then I found out about salsa, and then I realized that to be a good salsero, you had to be a good rumbero, but to be a good rumbero, you had to learn all this, you know, folkloric, you know, religious music, and that's kind of how I ended up, you know, ruining my life, and here I am today, you know, as the result of a ruined life.
Now, is there one teacher, mentor that you would say, wow, that has really put me forward a lot? And what was your first time in Cuba?
Let's see. Well, I have to say that I feel like I had several mentors. And so with your permission, I feel obligated to name them because I can't put one more important than the other. My first would be a man here in San Francisco. Everybody, I live in San Francisco, California. His name is Marcus Gordon.
Oh, I know him, yeah.
Okay, well, Marcus put Eleques on me. We can talk about that later. And was my first folkloric teacher. I should say my first teacher was a guy named Kenneth Nash. And I mention him because he was a pretty well-known jazz conga player who was not interested in playing non-American music, but his whole concept of rhythm was very advanced. He played with Andy Norell and, you know, the steel pan player, and Michael White, who was a famous jazz violinist. And Kenneth had told me, well, if you want to learn all that non-American stuff, you should go see this guy, Marcus Gordon. So Marcus Gordon was the guy that really introduced me to folkloric music. So I need to mention him. But he was not like a professional musician, so very few people would know about him. But my next really important mentor was a man named Francisco Aguabella.
Okay, a big one. Yeah.
I did 10 years with Francisco, and he, you know, he's like my dad. Then I had two other dads. Because of Francisco, I went to Cuba for the first time in 1984. Mm-hmm. And when I was there, I met the gentleman that Francisco had grown up with, whose name is Cha-Cha, Esteban Vega Bacallao, who was the quinto player for the Muñequitos de Matanzas for many years.
Yeah, we'll talk about this too, yeah.
Yeah, and Cha-Cha became my second father, if you will, or my third, I guess. And then he was in the city of Matanzas in Cuba. And then my last father, if you will, was a gentleman named Regino Jimenez, who I made a CD for him called Iluanya. Mm-hmm. Regino was from the city of Havana. And he initiated me as a priest into the tradition that I now follow. So I kind of have four: Marcus, Francisco, Cha-Cha, and Regino.
That's a pretty impressive lineup of mentors, yeah. Now, you actually have composed a lot of music, and our listeners, I think, are curious now, how does that sound? So with your permission, let's play the Maracambique. Is it a mixture of Mozambique and something?
Yes, and Maracatu. Maracatu, which is the...
Okay, yeah.
That's kind of what I'm known for in the percussion world, is I'm kind of the guy that has always made the connection of, in the African diaspora, of the relationship of West African music in Brazil and West African music in Cuba, not only those two places, but primarily, and tried to musically draw the connection that when the Africans came to the New World, their music obviously was reconstructed in new ways in the New World, but that there are common threads that run throughout, so that you can go to Bahia in Brazil and you can go to Matanzas in Cuba and hear the same song. So Maracambique is my tribute to carnival music, if you will, the music of Carnaval from the northeastern part of Brazil.
Linda, yeah.
And Havana, and with the Mozambique.
Yeah, I've been in the carnival in Olinda and have really seen all these maracatu processions with the bonecas, with the puppets.
That's wonderful. I am jealous. I cannot say the same. I wish I had been there for that.
Okay, let's listen to that, okay?
Yeah.
Mozambique, no hay nada igual. Como en Mozambique, no hay nada igual.
Mozambique from Michael Sparrow. I think he's a band that you put together yourself, right? That
we're well, hearing. Actually, that's all of the percussion. I did this together with my protege and my student. He's my godson, etc. He obviously is not obviously, but you could figure it out. He's a steel pan player. So we added Trinidad to the Cuba Brazil thing. So this was the tribute to Carnaval, you know, throughout the Americas. He and I, and one of my grad students, her name is Kristen Olson. We did all of the percussion except for some of the maracatu stuff that I took to my friend Scott Kettner in New York. And we recorded him and me together at his place. But it's basically almost all overdubs. And then obviously I'm not a horn player, so I had to bring horn players in. And the singers, also Scott brought his singers from Brazil who were in New York to sing the background vocals for the Brazilian stuff.
Wonderful. Salutes to the Carnival of the... Yeah. Latin American countries. Now, before we go deeper into the traditions, I have a very personal question, which is, what has drums and percussion done for your personal life?
That's like an impossible question to answer because it's my whole life.
Mm-hmm. Let me put it that way. What would what would not be in your life if you have never met a drum?
Nothing about my life would be what it has been or would be today without drums. I probably would have become a professor of sociology or political science or something like that. I'm the child of academics and I probably would have, you know, pursued that also for political reasons. I'm pretty left kind of guy and would have gone into the academy to try to move social justice forward. I mean, everything about my life is because of the drum. I mean, that sounds very cliched and I know that. And it can also sound a little dramatic and I don't mean it that way. It's just what's true.
Yeah, yeah. Now I go a little deeper even. Do you find some human qualities you could build with your drumming? Like, resilience, like calmness, whatever. Is that something you can point towards?
I want to say that I became a conga player, quote unquote, by accident, but I'm kind of the old school, the skin on skin, the actual hand hitting a drum rather than a stick. There's something very tactile about that. And there's something very emotionally fulfilling. Maybe it's the opposite of peaceful about, wham, like just, you know, really being able to play an instrument with effort, physical effort, rather than, you know, pressing a little key down, or, and I, you know, I'm not trying to minimize the value of a piano or a flute or whatever, but okay, here's a hand, go. And there's something very fulfilling about that act, at least for me.
Yeah, very clear. So what you say, and thank you for going so deep with me. I really want to get this out of you. You know what?
Of course, sure.
And so let me ask another question. Is that right that you could say the Latin American, especially Cuban rhythms, and I would also say Afro-Brazilians, come from the tradition of Ifa, African tradition of Ifa. So when you learn conga, you kind of always have to go to the Bata rhythms. And if you're in the Bata rhythms, you have the Santeria. And I think it's a good opportunity to let people who have never heard this word or so know what intelligent system that is, you know, what is an Orisha and how this is all structured.
Yeah, I think that is a true statement, except with one small caveat, which is the Yoruba who brought Ifa or Ifism, if you will, and the Bata drums to Cuba, they were the last of the main African groups to be brought as slaves to Cuba. But before them and in much actual larger numbers were the Congolese and the Bantu people, and their music also is critical to an understanding of the conga drum, if you will, along with the Caravali, you know, the Yabacoa people in Cuba. So I do believe that almost every rhythm that you can find in Cuban music, you can find it in Bata drumming, but you can also find roots and parts of it in the other African systems that were brought to Cuba. I would just, with that one little caveat, that it's not the only system, but yes, my own life experience was that in order to be a salsero, I discovered that I had to be a rumbero. And in order to be a rumbero, I discovered that I had to be a bata player. And that's what then led me to my whole life's path, if you will.
Now, when I first saw batas, I was in Cuba in 76, the first time.
Damn, really?
Yes, I have something for you here. Let's play this right now. This is from 76. And it's in Santiago de Cuba.
Wow. That's your recording?
Yes, yes, of course.
And is that Los Hoyos? Do you remember which group that was?
No, I don't. It was too long ago. I was really new to everything. And as I told you, I said the first time there's three drums, the Ia Ogonkoloni Totele, and three people and six kids. I say, how can they play these rhythms? It's so crazy.
So how did you end up in Santiago de Cuba in 1976?
There was a group actually from San Francisco that was allowed a musician group to go, a group of musicians, it was not a band, to go into Cuba. So we had a special permission to do that. And we were there for more than, I think, 3 weeks because the crowd went on and on and on. Yeah, it was right. The very beginning, you know, when it was very different. It was not open to anything, but it was very original.
Well, when I went in 1984, my first time, it wasn't really open then either. That created enormous, as you know, the 1980s were the most interesting time to be traveling. underground, you know, between the United States and Cuba.
Now, we can clearly see the Batas are connected to Santeria, right?
Yeah, of course.
And would you like to explain to our listeners, if someone has never heard Santeria, how would you explain Santeria?
The first thing is that the word itself is complicated. People say the word Santeria. There are some issues with that because to the people who don't know the word, Santeria is a name that people use to refer to the religion in Cuba that was brought there by the Yoruba people from southwestern Nigeria. And then you say, well, Santeria sounds like a Spanish word. What does that have to do with Yoruba culture? Well, the notion is that when the Africans got to the New World, they hid their religion when they could in Catholic countries colonized by Catholics, using the saints to hide the worship of their deities, because Yoruba theology is much like Greek or Roman mythology. There's an almighty being, and then there are many deities underneath. So Zeus is the big god, but then underneath Zeus is Aphrodite and so forth, all the Greek gods. So in Yoruba culture, Olodumare is the main god, and then underneath him, there's a whole number of other gods. And the notion was that the Africans could match their deities with Catholic saints, and then sort of hide from the Spaniards that they were worshiping. I don't happen to believe that, to be honest with you. That's a whole other discussion, maybe not for music time. But the notion then is that there was some sort of syncretism between Yoruba faith or Ifism, Ifa, and Catholic tradition. And so Santeria becomes the word that says, well, it's an African faith, but it has all these other components. And in particular, the Catholic component of saints. This is probably not the place for it, but I have issues with a lot of that. I think that there are times where, yes, the Yoruba religion in Cuba manifests in some Christian Catholic way, but most of us would say that we practice regla de ocha, the rule of ocha, the rule of the oricha, because we don't necessarily think that we're that Catholic in what we do. Is that a fair way to put that?
Yeah. Now, I'm always, you know, thinking for the listeners who have never heard this, and
yeah,
they would ask, well, how are then bata drums, or how are drums at all connected to orishas? Or,
you know? In Cuba, and I want to say that because if we go all the way back to Nigeria, then it gets complicated, right? So, and then we need, you know, 5 hours instead of 1 hour. So in Cuba, the bata drums, which are double-headed drums played in sets of three, they're hourglass-shaped. There's three drummers, and each drummer puts the drum on their lap, and you sort of play sideways because they're double-headed. Every oricha, every deity in this tradition, in this religion, has his or her own, not only songs, but specific rhythms. There are many, many of them. This is a lifelong study. This is not something you learn in a week. It's something you learn in decades. And each of these rhythms is specific. There are rhythms that are generic, if you will, that get played for all of the different oricha, but every oricha has his or her own specific rhythm. Those rhythms are played both what we call seco, meaning dry, like dry wine, just the rhythms, and then
singing.
And then they're used to accompany singing and dance. The music is a critical part to worship, much like gospel church in the United States. You can't go to a Baptist church in the United States and have a service on Sunday without the choir. The music is integral to the worship. So although there are many, many ceremonies in this tradition that do not involve the drums, there are very few that I can think of that do not involve music at some point. It might just be singing without the drumming accompaniment, but song, drumming, and dance, this religion doesn't exist without those three components.
Exactly. Now, because people will get very curious, how does that sound? I suggest that I play one thing I recorded together with Milton Cardona. It's just pure Santeria also.
When did you record that?
That was 1990.
In New York?
No, this was on the Megadrums tour.
Wow, fabulous. Who's playing with him? I'm curious.
I was playing the Itotele, and a student of mine was playing Ogonkolonji, of course. Uh-huh. He was playing Iya. This was before I made Santo, and so... Uh-huh. I would really, if you won't mind, to share with us, how was your way into Santeria?
My way was pretty simple. First time I ever heard bata drums, I didn't even know what they were, and I went, that's me.
Okay.
I didn't even know what it was. All I knew was, like, literally, that sounds very cliched, love at first sight. It was literally... I just went, whatever that is, that's what I want to do with my life. Wow. And so back then, in the United States at any rate, this was in the 1970s. The only Cubans really in the United States at the time that knew bata drumming were the man I mentioned before, Francisco Alaea, and the man who became my godfather in Ifá, Julito Collazo. Mm-hmm. And they wouldn't teach anybody. It was a secret. Like, there was no teaching anybody bata drums. So Marcus Gordon, who I mentioned was kind of my first dad in all this, he had been studying bata in New York and had gone to Cuba. And he was the man who brought bata drumming to the San Francisco Bay Area. And he had become my teacher for many years before that, but of other stuff, rumba and bembe and so forth. So when I was in graduate school in Seattle, Washington in 1980, he contacted me and said that he was going to start teaching bata drums if I wanted to come back to the Bay Area to study. And so I did, but the deal was that he wouldn't teach unless you did your initial initiation to get your eleques. Eleques, everybody, are like sacred necklaces that you receive as your initial initiation into this tradition. Mm-hmm. And so kind of one thing just led to another in that sense, that the music is what called me. And then the more I started to play and study the music, the more the theological aspects of it called me. And so again, when you ask me, you know, what my life would be like without drums.
Yeah.
I mean, I've been a priest now. I was initiated as a priest in 1998. So that's 23 years. And I've been playing, initiated as a sacred bata player in 1982. So that's 40 years. And I have two sets of fundamento, meaning sacred drums. One from Havana, one from Matanzas, meaning without the drum, my life, I mean, you know, it's completely became my life.
Mm. Wow, beautiful. Wonderful, actually. And you composed also a lot of music around Orishas, like Osain.
Yeah.
That is, of course, the Orisha of the mountains and the plants and... I think they have Osain, of course, also in Candomblé. Candomblé, you know, being the equivalent to Santeria in Brazil. If you agree with that.
Absolutely, I do.
Okay. And so I want to just play a little bit of this wonderful composition of your Osain, okay? Let's listen to that. Berimbau. Sign from Mike Sparrow. Now, where did you record this? In Brazil or in...
This was recorded both here in the Bay Area. My co-artist on this project, the name of the project is Bataketu.
Yeah.
It was the intentionally, Ketu is the style of drumming from Candomblé. And Bata, of course, from we'll call it Santeria. And my co-artist, his name is Mark Lamson. Mm-hmm. And we did almost all of the Cuban stuff, all the percussion and the vocals here in the Bay Area. Mm-hmm. And then the background singing, no, the Brazilian vocals, all of them were done in Rio de Janeiro.
Oh, cool. Yeah.
With my friend and running partner and so forth, my mentor in Brazilian music, his name is Jorge Alabe. Mm-hmm. And so he sang lead and he found, you know, people from his Tejeru, from his, from Candomblé House to sing the background vocals.
Now, Michael, isn't that amazing? Like, you have three batas and you have three atabaques in Candomblé. Yeah. And both traditions, the lead drum is the deep drum, you know, the hum and the ya in the English.
Exactly. That's And I think that that's the thing that Americans are not used to is learning to play the low drum and speak there. Rather, we always think of the speaking voice, you know, being the soprano or the flute or the trumpet. And so we have to change our, you know, our aesthetic and learn how to make one note really count. You know what I mean? It's because you can't play 32nd notes on a low drum with, you know, it won't speak. So you have to really then understand that speaking, particularly to the supernatural world, you have to learn how to do that. It's not about speed and, you know, how fast you can play. It's what to play.
Mm, absolutely. But in rumba, when we go to that, it's not the quinto, the lead drum, in a way.
Yes, which is why then you would say that rumba is one of the first cases then of Creole music where the Europe, it's not, that's one of the ways you can know it's not African music, is that rumba has to be Creole music, Cuban music, because now the lead voice is the high voice.
Yeah. And by the way, congratulations to this project of Rumba de Encazuela. I saw the little trailer of it.
Thank you.
Fantastic. When will the whole film be out?
I made a movie of my godmother, my madrina, and her entire sort of rumba family singing and playing all of the old rumbas from 100 years ago that gave rise to the rumbas of today. And it's called Los Bandos. And at the moment, if you go to congamasterclass.com, that's one word, congamasterclass.com, and which is a teaching site, website that I've had for many years with my buddy Jesus Diaz. But if you click on the videos, you can see this video. I'm not quite yet ready to just put it on YouTube for free because I'm trying to generate enough income to give them some money, right? I'm trying to actually put money in their pocket. So if you go to congamasterclass.com, click on videos and click on Los Bandos, that's the name of the project. It'll cost you in American money, $3.99. It's like a performance documentary. I think, yes, I made it, so I'm completely biased, but I think it's awesome. The playing is fabulous. The singing is fabulous. And they tell their story about where this music came from and how they're moving it forward in their own, in the town of Matanzas. I think if you like rumba and you like Cuban music, you will love this. And I hate to charge you $3.99, but I'm trying to put money in their pocket, especially now because of the pandemic. Cubans are suffering terribly. They don't have food, they don't have medicine, and they can't leave the house because they're in quarantine. So in addition to great music, if you'd like to help some folks out, It would be awesome if you would go there.
I absolutely invite every of our listeners to do that. I just saw the little clip. I'm certainly checking out the whole thing today. I'm so curious. It's beautiful footage in Cuba, you know, from. It doesn't get more original than this if you really want to know. Matanzas, is shot in Matanzas?
Or? Yes, yes, it's completely that. Because what happened in Matanzas is 100 years ago, they started to have social clubs that on New Year's Eve would go out and sing rumbas the way here in the United States. I don't know about Europe, but in the U.S., we have this thing called Christmas caroling from the way back when, where you'd go out on Christmas Eve and you'd go from house to house singing Christmas songs. Well, they would go from house to house on New Year's Eve singing rumba. And when you got to Reinhardt's house, he would meet you with the bottle of rum, you know, and everybody has a shot. And then we would sing rumba for Reinhardt, and then he would leave his house, join us. We go off to the next house. Well, all of those rumbas are what then gave rise to the groups that people today would know about. Los Muñequitos de Matanzas, Afro-Cuba de Matanzas, etc. The root of all that music goes back to what they called themselves then, Los Bandos. Because after they would eat, then they would go out to the street to sing, and then they would come back and eat some more. Now it's New Year's Day, and then you go home and fall asleep.
Well, Michael, thank you so much for doing this project. It's fantastic because there's nothing like that really out. And Matanzas is really the capital of rumba, I would say.
Yeah. And so you
made this beautiful thing. If you had any money right now, just not worried about it, what would you do? What would be the project you would like to do most if you had no question about money?
Wow. If I had no question about money, I would probably want to do the Osain track that you played, you know, which the Bataketu, which is like my first project that really, you know, mixed and matched and demonstrated, you know, Cuban Brazil. The whole record is a folkloric record, meaning it's just percussion and singing. I think if I had unlimited budget, I would keep that same concept, but I would try to merge it with popular music. By popular music, I don't mean hip hop or reggaeton or any of that crap, but like real, like full band, you know, Tower of Power. It would take us from the past into the present, Brazil and Cuba back and forth, samba meets timba, meets rumba, meets, you know, etc. That, of course, would take an enormous amount of money, which is certainly not within my budget. Let's put it that way.
Yes, thank you so much for coming on my show today. It's a real pleasure, and so much information you've given us, really. Let's pray for all the people, basically, on the world right now, you know, especially for this people who are like in Cuba or in Brazil as well. I mean, three times every year in Brazil are also suffering a lot under this circumstance.
It's really horrible. Mm. Horrible.
So, again, thank you very much for coming on. And
absolutely, my pleasure. What a wonderful opportunity to get to meet you. And separate from this, I hope we will continue our communication, because I think you and I have a lot to continue to share back and forth.
Absolutely. Where are you based right now?
I'm based in San Francisco.
Okay.
For over a decade, I was a professor at a university in the United States called Indiana University. Mm-hmm. But I retired from that, and now I'm here in the San Francisco Bay Area, kind of waiting for life to hopefully return to some, you know.
Yes, we all hope for that, really.
Yeah, yeah.
Mike, all the best for your life. It was such a pleasure to meet you. And for your listeners, I mean, this was beyond belief. I knew that we'll get some in-depth information, but it was beyond my expectations for sure. If you like our discussion, go to powerofrhythm.com/podcast and leave a comment. Maybe you have some questions. Write them there. I'll try to get back to you. And if I can't answer, I write it to Michael. And he
yes, absolutely, it. Everybody. Don't be shy. We're here, all here in the world right now together trying to survive. More than happy to connect with people. It's totally my pleasure, Reinhardt. Thank you so much for the opportunity. I'm very grateful.
Absolutely. And for you listeners, have a great time and keep on grooving.